We come this evening to the last of the lessons of manners and customs that we'll look at in this particular series. As we come to this particular one, we're going to be mainly talking about burials in the Bible. And I want to call your attention to the fact that we're talking about burials and not about funerals. A large difference between the two in the picture of the Bible itself. The Bible pictures many times the burials of individuals. It pictures very few times the aspect of funerals of individuals. However, just to be straightforward with it, right from the start, there are a few what you might call funerals talked about in the Bible. The most elaborate funeral probably talked about in the Bible is found in Genesis chapter 50. And the majority of that chapter, and especially the first 12, 13 verses of it, deals with the funerals that took place with Jacob. And Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. Joseph commanded his servants and the physicians to embalm his father, and the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were fulfilled for him, so are fulfilled the days of those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. And so you have the 40 days fulfillment of the embalming, then you've got 70 days, 7 days mentioned for the mourning for him. If those are two separate accounts, you've got a lot of days involved in the time of his death here. And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the Pharaoh and said, Now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray thee, into the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, lo, I die in my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan, there thou shalt bury me. Now therefore let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. And Pharaoh said, go up, and bury thy father according as he hath made thee swear. And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of the house, all the elders of the land of Egypt, all the house of Joseph, and his brethren, and his father's house, only the little ones from their flocks and their herds they left in the land of Goshen. And they went up with him, both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. So you've got 7 more days besides travel time involved now. And when the inhabitants of the land and the Canaanites saw the mourning at the floor of Atad, they said, this is grievous mourning for the Egyptians. Wherefore the name of the place is called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond Jordan. And his sons did unto him according to as he commanded them. For his sons carried him into the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah, which Abraham brought to the field for possession for a burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. And so here you have elaborate detail talked about in the case of Jacob or Israel being taken and being buried. And elaborate detail in the aspect of what took place and what we might call the mourning time that was associated with his death. There again, that's a very elaborate detail given there. And very few places in the Bible do you find that type of detail. We come over to Lazarus. I mean, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, that Lazarus in the New Testament. And we find there that they had a period of mourning that was probably a 7 day, a full week, as was the nature of the Jews to mourn for the death of their loved ones. So you have that period of time talked about in the Bible, and that might be considered to be a funeral mourning time before the burial, surrounding the burial. The burial often was almost immediate in those New Testament times. Nowhere do you find more simplicity in the aspect of a funeral than you find in Acts the 5th chapter, though. In Acts the 5th chapter, you have the confrontation between Peter and the apostles and Ananias and Sapphira. And as they have this confrontation, and Ananias has lied to the Holy Spirit, and he has in that lie, has been caught in that lie, and he falls down dead. And the verse 6, and the young men arose, wound him up, carried him out, and buried him. And there you have that simplicity that's going to be found in the New Testament as we talk about these things. And you can come on down to verse 10 and read there, and you find also she died, fell down, and those that had buried her husband come in and at that moment take her out and buried her by her husband. A very simplicity, a very simple form in describing what was done in the aspect of any type of funeral or burial procedure. The interesting thing is, this is about the last that you find mentioned of it in any great detail in the New Testament. As you pass through the book of Acts and you go into the letters and on through the book of Revelation, you find very little mentioned about any type of funeral, burial procedure. I believe there's purpose behind that. Because for the New Testament Christian, the focus not only moved from the aspect of the sorrow for death and the burial and the aspect of that, but the focus for the Christian, according to 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, moved to the resurrection. It moved to look at what was coming, not what had passed. It moved to looking to the joy of heaven instead of dealing with the trials and tribulations that they had undergone on earth. And this is a very interesting move as we find through the New Testament, because as you come through the period of time, and especially the great Roman persecution of the Christians, where Christians die in the amphitheater and there's very little left of a Christian's body to bury, but the hope of the resurrection is never minimized. It's never taken away. It's always there before. Now, to clarify what we're doing tonight, we're not talking about the aspect of the funeral procedure, because we just simply don't find much about that biblically. What we are going to talk about is we're going to look at some things about burials as we find them talked about in the Bible. We're going to again break this down according to the different periods of the Bible. We're going to look first of all in that patriarchal period and look at some of the things that are just noted there about burials. Find first of all in Genesis 35, beginning in verse 19. Sometimes during this early time, they buried them in rock cones. And all this was they laid the person out. Sometimes they would dig a shallow hole. Sometimes they'd lay the person on top of the ground, and they would simply cover them with a mound of rocks. This type of burial has been done from those very early times all the way down into modern times. If you read about a lot of the things concerning the time period, the Western time period, the Western expansion of our nation, sometimes individuals were buried in exactly this same manner. They would be in areas where it was dry, the ground was hard, they couldn't dig a grave, and so they would put the individual there, cover them with stones so that animals and what have you could not break in to get the body, and they were buried in that manner. Rachel died and was buried in the way to Ephratah, which is Bethlehem. Here Jacob and his family is returning to Canaan, Bethel. And as they return, Rachel dies. She's buried here. And Jacob set up a pillar over upon her grave that is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day. And because it makes note of the pillar being set up over it, many think that she's buried in some type of rock cairn or rock covering like is being talked about. Now, also during this time period, they buried them often near landmarks. Genesis 35, verse 8. Here you have a note made concerning Rebekah's nurse, Deborah. But Deborah's, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak. And the name of it was called, and the name's given there. And here you have a simple noting. Now, the interesting thing is, this is not chronological. This is talking about Jacob's return again, and Deborah died, Rebekah's nurse died years before. What it's talking about is giving us a geographical marker, and the geographical marker is the burial point of Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, and she's buried here underneath an oak. So she's buried underneath the oak. The oak is the marker. The name that is given to the oak is the Oak of Weeping. And that's where this big name comes from here. And so here again, you find this, and this becomes a very common practice to bury an individual near some structure, whether it be a tree or a rock formation or that nature, so that burial site could easily be found in the years following. And this often happened in this patriarchal period. But also you had caves and tombs that were used. Genesis 23, verse 17. The most noted cave or burial place of this nature in the patriarchal was Abraham's. And the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field, and were all the borders round about it, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children ahead, before all that went in the gate of the city. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan. So here you find Abraham is burying Sarah in this cave. He bought it for that purpose. He bought it from the inhabitants of the land. It became his. It remained his and his descendants for years and years to come. Now, if you remember a while ago when we read about the burial of Jacob, Jacob also was buried. Abraham was buried in this same tomb. Isaac's buried in this same tomb. And so you find during that day and time when they purchased or bought a cave or made a tomb for burial, often many generations were buried in the same tomb. This is the time period that we find the first introduction to what was called ossuary jars. The common name given to them was bone jars. And what it was, they would bury an individual in a tomb until all the flesh was decayed. And once the flesh was decayed, they would go in with a large jar, move all the bones into the jar, cover that jar, label it, and move it aside. And so the next generation could be laid out on the tables, the benches inside the tomb, until the same process happened. So over the years, you might have a great number of jars stacked against the wall of the tomb where generation after generation, the individuals had been buried in the same tomb. Now, as we look at this period, we're going to look at a specific aspect of it, and that's during the Exodus time and the time that they possessed the land of Canaan. Because during that time, it became more and more common to purchase a specific ground to be buried in. And a lot of individuals biblically are mentioned as being buried in that was purchased or that was given to them as a land, as being theirs. See it in Joshua. Joshua 24:32 first. And here we're speaking about Joseph. Now, the interesting thing about Joseph is 24:32, Joshua. As we look at the aspect of Joseph here, Joseph was taken and was buried in Shechem. Okay, the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, buried they in Shechem in a parcel ground which Jacob brought of the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver. And so here you have Joseph buried in a burial place that was purchased by Jacob. Joseph was not buried when he died. Joseph was embalmed in Egypt. His body, in essence, was kept in a casket until the Israelites left Egypt. I don't know exactly how many years it was. I know that from the time that Jacob went down to Egypt till they came out of Egypt was about some 400 years. Now, feature this. Jacob purchased this land before he went to Egypt. And so Jacob owned this burial ground at Shechem before he went to Egypt, which was some 400 years before Joseph is taken to this ground. But Joseph has been dead at least 200 or 300 years before he's taken to this ground and buried. But it was the burial place. The promise was made to Joseph that he would be taken back and buried in the family burial place when the children of Israel left Egypt. And that promise was carried out. Also see in other places, Genesis 33, verses 18 through 20. And you see this purchase of this place. Jacob came to Shalem, a city in Shechem, which is by the land of Canaan. Then he came to Padan-Aram, pitched his tent before the city, and he bought a parcel in the field where he spread his tent. So all of these years earlier, you go back to Genesis 33, and you read about him purchasing this particular burial ground. Joshua, you see the same thing. Joshua 24, verse 30. Joshua is buried in a piece of ground that became labeled as his own. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance Timnath-Serah, which is in the Mount Ephraim on the north side of the hill of Goshen. And so Joseph here, being the great leader that he was, not Joseph, Joshua, being the great leader that he was, is taken and buried in the part that he inherited. And so this became very common to have a specific burial place, and often these burial places went for generations upon generations. Great men were often buried in their father's burial place. And again, it was common to note this. Judges 8:32, you remember Gideon. Gideon became a great judge and a leader for Israel, took them out of control of the Midianites. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died in a good old age and was buried in the sepulcher of Joash's father. And so several times you read this fact, this type of fact. Judges 16, verse 31. And even if the son wasn't quite all that what he should be, he sometimes still was buried there. Then his brethren, all the house of his father, came down, took him and brought him up and buried him between Zoar and Eshtaol in the burying place of Manoah, his father, and he judged Israel 20 years. Now, if you know who Manoah was, you know who was buried there. Remember? Samson. And so Samson here, although Samson had all the problems that he had, although he went against what God told him to do, when he was brought back, he was brought back and buried. He was buried again in his father's burying place. So often that was done. And burial caves and tombs were sometimes cut outside of rock, outside of the villages. Often the burial tombs were not immediately in the village, but some distance from the village. And that just seems to indicate the perception that the burial place was unclean. And the uncleanliness of the burial place came down even through the New Testament time. But also we need to remember that embalming was not a Jewish practice. And since embalming was not a Jewish practice, it was the case that sometimes the burial places were some distance from where people lived, simply because there sometimes was an odor associated with the burying aspect, especially as they were put in caves and tombs, simply a rock rolled over the door. Again, we see that in the case of Lazarus in the New Testament. Remember when Jesus came to the tomb of Lazarus and inquired about rolling the stone away, he was told, well, he has been dead 4 days. His body yet stinketh. And so you have that aspect taking place in the burying. And then as we come through the Old Testament period, and especially as we come down into the period of the law, the giving of the Mosaical law, it becomes law that every dead body basically is to be buried. That was God's directive. And as God gave that directive, usually the bodies were buried and quickly buried, but sometimes strange things would interfere with the burial of the body. The kings were nearly always buried in the king's tombs or the tombs of the father. Not every king was buried in the king's tomb. Sometimes the kings weren't buried in the king's tomb because they were deemed not worthy to be buried in the king's tomb. But you have a strange occurrence taking place in 1 Kings 13, beginning in 29. You have here a prophet of Judah that God has sent to Israel to prophesy. And this young prophet has gone to prophesy against Jeroboam. And in the process of prophesying against Jeroboam, this young prophet disobeys the commandment of God. God had told him not to eat or drink in Israel, but to return in a certain way. He violated that commandment by going home with an old prophet that lied to him. After he left the old prophet's house, he was met by a lion, and the lion killed him. The old prophet, who was a prophet of God but was living an evil life, that's a difficult one to talk about. And the old prophet took up the carcass of the man of God, laid it upon the donkey or the ass, and brought it back. And the old prophet came to the city, mourned, and buried him. And he laid his carcass in his own grave and mourned over him, saying, alas, my brother. And so after all this goes on, this old prophet lies and this young prophet dies because of the old prophet's lie. The old prophet goes out, takes the young prophet's body, brings it to his own tomb, and buries it. Now, that becomes significant later on. 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 17. Later on, there comes a king that's godly, that's righteous in Judah, Josiah by name. And Josiah, in his zeal from God, goes up to Israel, where all of these kings and prophets are buried, and he digs up the graves of them and burns the bones. Okay. Then said he, 2 Kings 23, yeah, 17. Then said he, what title is this that I see? And Josiah is looking at all of these tombs for these kings and prophets. He said, what is that written on that tomb? And the men of the city told him, it is the sepulcher of the man of God which came from Judah and proclaimed these things that thou hast done against the altar of Bethel. And so Josiah was told, this tomb is the tomb where the young prophet came up and was buried by the old prophet after he lied to him. And Josiah said, verse 18, let him alone, let no man move his bones. And so out of all the tombs that were there of these prophets and all that had spoke against God, this one burial spot is left alone. The interesting intermediate to this story is, after burying the young prophet in his own tomb, when the old prophet died, he said, you bury me on top of his body. Therefore, both the young prophet and the old prophet's grave is not disturbed and his bones are not burned when all the other false prophets' bones are burned by Josiah. And so you have interesting things like this of individuals being buried, more than one individual to a grave, and sometimes it's a very strange aspect that runs to it. But again, the prophets spoke of the king's family, and a lot of times these kings that were designated to be buried in certain ways, sometimes they weren't buried at all. Matter of fact is, Jeroboam the first was prophesied against and says, and that those of you of your family that die in the city shall the dogs eat, and those of you that die in the field shall the fowls eat. 1 Kings 21, verse 24. And those things occurred. You may remember the case of Ahab and Jezebel and what happened to them. And Jezebel died in the city, and her entire bones and flesh, except for just a very small part of her hands, was consumed by the dogs. And so sometimes these very wicked individuals were not buried at all. Their bodies were left. Sometimes individuals had no one that would bury a body. And because no one would bury the body would lay there until it just nature and the carrion consumed it. God specified that was not to be the normal case, though. In Deuteronomy 21, verse 23, if you have a criminal that was put to death because of his crime, he was specifically to be buried the same day. His body was not allowed to remain even up on the tree. This becomes interesting in the aspect of Christ dying on the cross. Also then, you find sometimes a body would be found. And if a body is found, who buries that body that's found? Deuteronomy 21, verses 1 through 9. And here, if you look especially at this text, the center part of this text, if a body is found, they are to measure the distance from that dead body to the cities around about it, and the people of the nearest city are to come and take care of that body that's found. It wasn't to be left there. If there was no one else responsible, the nearest village became responsible for the body. But then you had other strange things like Saul's sons. And Saul's sons, as they were taken, and because of the conflict that occurred between David and others, the Gibeonites, Saul's sons were taken and they were hanged. And their hanged bodies were left for an entire season hanging. Rizpah, the mother of one of those hanged sons, sat there at that side of that hanging and kept the wild animals off of the bodies for a long period of time until finally King David heard about it. And King David heard about it. He had those bodies taken, brought home with Saul and Jonathan's, and all of it burned and then reburied. And again, that's, I think that's the only cremation you read about in the Bible. I believe that cremation was done because of the condition of the bones and the bodies that were being talked about. Now, we'll not get into debate about whether cremation is all right or burial is all right, except to say this. Any God that can raise a buried body that has gone back to earth can raise a body from ashes. I think you ought to just think about that. What we're talking about is not substantially different in either case. But nevertheless, the tombs, again, and their location also told great deals about the individual. Sometimes it told about societal level of the individual. Sometimes kings and wealthy families would build, in, as we were talking about, in very special places. Sometimes they would go and make a king's tomb and cut it out of solid rock. An elaborate work in that day and time when there was no heavy machinery to do the work. And therefore, they would cut this out and bury the king in that elaborate tomb that has been made. In 1 Kings 15, verse 8, you find an interesting aspect connecting with this. Of course, this is going to talk about Judah. And Abijam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his stead. Sometimes as you go through the kings, it's very simple in the statement like this. Abijam was king. He died. When it says he was buried in the city of David, that means he was buried in the king's tomb, in the area where the kings were buried. In 1 Kings 16, verse 6, you go into the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. You find such things also stated. So Baasha, a king of Israel, slept with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah. Tirzah at the time was the capital of the northern kingdom. And so there again it mentions the fact that he was buried in that capital city. So often you find the kings were buried in this way. The royal tombs have been uncovered in Jerusalem. They've uncovered a whole series of royal tombs in what's called Ophel Hill on top of Zion. And you can go there, and archaeologists have gone there and found this whole series of kings, of tombs that they believe to be the tombs of the kings. Now, Absalom was never a king. He's not buried there. Absalom, it seems, went and made his, to some degree, his own arrangements, and I don't believe those arrangements were fully kept. In 2 Samuel chapter 18, verse 17. If you remember, Absalom was in rebellion when he was killed. And they took Absalom and cast him into a great pit in the wood and laid a very great heap of stones upon him. And so this stone carns that we read about earlier, that's what Absalom received. He receives that out in the woods. He's not buried in the city. He's buried immediately where he was, where he died. And so very likely there's nothing special about Absalom here. He just simply buried there. Sometimes the kings were buried in their own houses or in the garden of their houses. 2 Kings 21, verse 18. Manasseh, who reigned 55 years, was buried. And here you just simply read that he was buried in the garden of his own house. That was his burial place. I don't know if he had that chosen or what, but it was just that which was done. You find one interesting thing about a scribe named Shibna. Actually, it was treasury during Hezekiah's day. Let's read about it in the Bible. Isaiah 22, verse 15. A little interesting statement about Shibna. And God says, "Thus saith the Lord God of hosts, go get thee into the treasure, even to Shibna, which is over the house, and say," this is what Isaiah is supposed to go say to Shibna, "What hast thou here? And whom hast thou here? That thou hast hewed thee out a sepulcher here, as he heweth him out a sepulcher on high, and that graveth a habitation for himself in a rock." Now, what seems to happen here, Isaiah is told to go talk to Shebna. And what Shebna has done, he's gone to a very high place over the city. And he has contracted for an elaborate tomb to be cut out of solid rock for himself. And so evidently, some type of elaborate tomb was cut out of a rock, and Shebna was buried there. Archaeologists believe they have found that tomb. It is called today the Steward of the House, is the name that they've given to the tomb. And it consists of a single large chamber, and they really believe that it fits the time period and probably the description that Isaiah gives here about Shebna. What Shebna did, he put himself a place of glory. He put him a tomb way up high where for all the ages to come, the people could look up at the tomb from the city and say, there Shebna is buried. So he glorified himself. And so God tells Isaiah, you go out and you confront him. And then you have the tombs that take place during the exile and return. It's very little difference. A lot of things are buried with individuals during this time. Bowls and mirrors and bracelets and eye makeup and other things are buried with individuals in the graves. And some believe that this occurs because they believe in an afterlife. I don't know. But during this time, you come along to the 4th and 5th centuries before Christ, and they have two basic tombs. They have a tomb that is dug nearly straight down with a staircase, a very steep staircase that goes down into it. And usually only the wealthy have this type of tomb, but it goes down, and sometimes there was not one burial chamber, but they have found them that had as many as 4 burial chambers at the bottom of these stairways that go down into these area tombs. And the ones that have 4 burial chambers will have several generations. But during the same time period, most of the poor people just have what was called pit graves. And a pit grave, to some extent, was like what most people today are buried in, with one exception. They generally were shallow, and a lot of times they were unmarked. Now, you come into the time of Christ, Luke 11, verse 44, you may find an indication of this graves not being marked. Listen to it. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisee hypocrites, for ye are as graves which appear not, and the men that walk over them are not aware of them. And so here he makes that reference to the pits that have been dug, the people that have been buried. They are graves, but they don't appear to be as graves. Matter of fact is, men walk over them and not even aware that the grave exists. And that happened a lot as you come into the time of Christ. You see it also again in Matthew 27, verse 1. And when the morning was come, the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. They bound him and led him away. Then Judas comes back in, and Judas comes back in and sees he's condemned. He throws the money back to the priest in the temple. Verse 6 now. And as he does so, and the chief priest took the silver piece and said, it's not lawful to put them into the treasure because it's the price of blood. They took counsel and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, the field today is called the field of blood even into this day. Or tell them, the field of blood. Now, what happened with the money that was actually given to purchase information about Jesus, it was taken out and they bought the potter's field with it. A potter's field was actually a pock-marked field. The potter got from that field the clay that he needed to make his potter. Often it was left in a very rough shape. Once he had gotten what clay was useful for his benefit, the field was usually sold for very little. As we see in this case, 30 pieces of silver bought. And by the way, the 30 pieces of silver was the price of a wounded slave. That shows you how little had been bought. But this potter's field was purchased, and it was purchased for the purpose to bury strangers in. And often in these potter's fields, individuals might be buried without ever digging a hole because one of the holes that had already been used by the potter to dig clay for his pottery, the body was simply put into that hole and covered. Sometimes, it not being marked, it was not uncommon for graves to be uncovered when trying to put in another grave. You know, we even have sometimes that problem today in cemeteries. It wasn't long ago I was at a cemetery and they had hand dug a grave and had come on to a cast iron casket cover in a position in that graveyard where they had no known graves marked. And they estimated that the casket had probably been there since probably as long ago as the 1850s. And therefore, they just simply did not know that it was in that location. So, you know, that type of thing even happens today sometimes. But the burial places, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of people in our nation that were buried in the Western expansion whose graves were never marked. And many of them that were marked by a simple wooden cross that simply a few years took care of, and those graves were never known where they were after that. But just to remind you, in matters of eternity, it makes no difference. Okay, so you have these different types of situations happen, different types of burial places that are found. And as you come on through the New Testament times, you find many things out about the burial process. You find the aspect of washing the body being talked about, and they prepared the body. They put spices on the body to eliminate the smell. John 11:44, they would wrap the head if necessary to keep the mouths and the eyes closed. And usually this wrapping around the head was bound there for that purpose, and that was done a lot. It was done to Christ. And so these normal things happened during that case. You can read about it in the case of Jesus. Some of these things were done. He was dressed in a fine linen cloth, Matthew 27:59 even. And so during that time, there was a lot of care taken in the burial procedure, but it was done very quickly. In the process, there was sometimes a funeral, very little mention about it. You find a mention in Matthew 9:23. Of the music that was played. Jesus came to the ruler's house, saw the minstrels and the people making noise. And so here he comes to the ruler's house where the one has died, and as he comes there, they're already making the music, making noise. They're preparing to bury the individual, and yet Jesus tells them the young woman is not dead. He raises her after that point. But you get this picture of a few things that take place there. You know, you read some about Jesus' burial, John 20:1-9, and it describes a few of the things that took place in his burial, the things that took place when they went to the tomb, and they go into the tomb, they find the grave clothes laying in two separate places, and all of that. You know, and we could spend a lot more time with that because there's a lot of tradition, a lot of false tradition associated with it. Bible doesn't spend a great deal of time with that. Or we can go to 1 Corinthians, the 15th chapter, and beginning of verse 12, and talk about something significant. Listen to it. Now, if Christ be preached that he rose from the dead, how say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead? My friends, Christ rose from the dead. The Bible overwhelmingly gives that evidence. Here in 1 Corinthians 15, back in verse 5, Paul has overwhelmingly given the evidence. But then he sins, continues. But if there's no resurrection of the dead, then is Christ not risen? And if Christ be not risen, then our preaching is vain, and your faith is also vain. Yea, and we are found false witnesses of God, because we have testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he raised not up, if so be the dead rise not. Now, he's brought us our attention to the fact that Christ is raised and the dead do raise. That's his point. For if the dead rise not, then is Christ not raised. And if Christ be not raised, your faith is vain and you're yet in your sins. Then they also which are fallen asleep in Christ are perished. Watch him now. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable. But now is Christ risen from the dead, and become the first fruits of them that slept. For since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead. Friends, the thing that's really of importance is not the nature of one's funeral, the nature of one's burial. The thing that's really important is what after that? The Hebrew writer says in 9:27, his appointed man wants to die, and after this, the judgment. I do not care how great the funeral was, how magnificent. Whether it's a presidential body that's carried in a carriage, drawn by white horses, buried in Arlington Cemetery. Or whether it's the poorest, loneliest individual in the world, whose body is rolled off in a hole and covered with dust, like Lazarus probably did, and the rich man in Lazarus. What is important is what's going to happen in the resurrection day. John 5:28-29 tells us all of us, all that have been buried, all are going to hear his voice. All are going to come out of the graves. All are going to face the judgment. My friends, that's more important than all these other things combined. In the judgment day, in the resurrection, Christ is going to say, those on the right hand, go ye into the kingdom of my Father, prepared for you from the foundations of the world. And to those on the left hand, he's going to say, depart from me, ye that work iniquity, and everlasting punishment. Sometimes we become so concentrated about the grave, we forget the glory of the resurrection. In the resurrection, whose will you be? Have you been obedient to the will of God to enter into the kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world? Have you lived faithfully, justly, righteously, and treated your brethren and other people properly? Or are you in rebellion to God to depart for eternity into torments and smoke and pain and anger? It's your choice which you go to. You may not can choose all the matters of your funeral. I've seen people try and I've seen them been broken. You might not can choose where your old bones are buried. I've seen people try and I've seen that be broken. But my friends, the choice of your eternity doesn't belong to your spouse, doesn't belong to your children, it belongs to you as you stand before God at the judgment seat. What do you need to do as we stand and as we sing?